This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, Hillary Clinton's secret hit list. Also, the American middle class is disappearing. Can anything be done to stop it? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, is this year's Sochi Olympics reviving a bit of the Cold War in the American imagination? And then Legos, the toy that's been plaguing parents' feet for generations, is now a major motion picture.
I'm just going to come right out. I have no idea what's going on or what this place is at all.
Hi! I am Princess Unikitty, and I welcome you all to Cloud Cuckoo Land!
We'll start with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. A conservative website published a trove of secret documents about Hillary Clinton, while a new book praises her tenure as Secretary of State. Do Americans like Hillary's toughness or fear it? Then, the economy is recovering, sort of, but practically every penny of gain is going to the top 5% of Americans. The American middle class is vanishing at a shocking rate. Can anything be done to stop it? Joining me today are Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson from Florida. Hi, John.
Hello, David.
And from New York, Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
And a special guest, co-founder of Planet Money, Adam Davidson, also in New York. Hi, Adam.
Hey, David.
This week brings the publication of two very different sets of documents about Hillary Clinton. One is a book, HRC, Hillary Rodham Clinton, I guess that stands for, that recounts her time as Secretary of State in largely favorable terms. The other is called the Hillary Papers, and it's a set of private papers collected by the conservative website The Free Beacon. The Hillary Papers consist of the records, the private records of the late Diane Blair, who is a close friend of Hillary's, whose papers are held at an Arkansas University library, which are now are publicly available. The papers don't really have huge revelations in them, but we'll talk about that. But they do find a Hillary who was more aggressive and private during the Clinton presidency of the 90s than she was in public. So, John Dickerson, the first revelation in the book, HRC, was that Hillary Clinton had a hit list, they call it, of politicians she needed to pay back, or politicians she needed to reward for sticking by her in 2008 and needed to punish as well in 2008. Is it shocking? I mean, should we think of this as a Nixon's enemies list?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. In politics, particularly at the level that where she plays at and that her husband plays at, an enemies list is basically like it's a best practice. If you're going to play at that level, you need to have a list of the people who you've helped and who appreciated that help, and those people you helped and then screwed you. And there were a lot of them in her case because of the fight in the Democratic primary in 2008. So the fact that there was a hit list per se shouldn't bother anybody. And the way in which, you know, what ended up happening with the hit list is Bill Clinton then went out in subsequent campaigns, either for attorney general or for Congress, and campaigned in Democratic primaries against the people who had supported Barack Obama. So that all seems to me within bounds. Where it would get over the line would be if you kept an enemies list and your day was consumed with tending it, adding new people, devising new and baroque ways to destroy the people who were already on it. And there's not really any evidence that that's the case at all here. So she doesn't seem, from available evidence, to be kind of bound in the way Nixon was by his hatred.
So, Emily, was there anything else in either in the HRC or what you've read about HRC, because I don't think you've read the whole book, or in the Free Beacon documents, anything that revealed anything interesting about Hillary Clinton's character or thinking?
I don't think so, but the hunger with which I devoured these quotes and anecdotes, mostly from Diane Blair reporting what Hillary had said to her at various moments, including the Lewinsky affair. I think the reason this is news is that we're all starved for some glimpse into Hillary Clinton's inner life, that there's a way in which I think she has been forced by politics to keep that part of herself as closed off and separate from us as possible. And so even though we've been exposed to her now for, what, so many years, more than 20 years, she still remains a little bit of an enigma. You're just not sure which of your perceptions of her to trust. And so to me, honestly, it was just a relief to have her sounding off about Monica Lewinsky. Of course she thought Monica Lewinsky was, you know, narcissistic and Looney Tunes because, A, that was true, and B, she was the wronged wife in the situation. So it seems to me like it was all pretty human and honestly kind of restrained given what was happening.
Adam, did you share Emily's longing to know more about the real Hillary Clinton, and you felt that that was rewarded by these papers from the 90s?
I got to say, I was shocked at how rewarded I was by reading these notes that Hillary, one of her very best friends, would write right after talking to Hillary on the phone and take very careful notes of exactly what Hillary said. And there was just, I think it's just one page or maybe it's two pages of how Hillary thought through how to deal with the Monica issue. And it was so human and so, it made me wish I could go back in time and tell myself, you know, that Hillary, she really is much more of a real person than you realize. It talked about how pained she was. Here's Bill Clinton, her best friend for 25 years, it says, and how she understands how he slipped up, how she realizes how alone he is, that she still has people like this Diane Blair she can talk to, but Bill has no one he can talk to. So she was very understanding, which I don't know, maybe not many people would be that understanding, but still very mad at him. And she was able to compartmentalize her personal relationship with Bill to her feelings about the Republicans going after her husband as a political figure. I found it really human. I mean, I feel like the campaign in embryo should be thrilled that this is out, was my feeling.
You know, it's funny that you guys had that reaction that these humanize her. Maybe there's something wrong with me. I've never felt any problem humanizing Hillary Clinton. She always has seemed like a relatively human, if somewhat private, person. She's been in public life for her whole adult life, and she's been in national public life for more than 20 years. We know, we've learned that she's beloved by her employees. She's very loyal to her employees. We know that she has a very complicated, intense, and loving relationship with her husband. We know that she's incredibly hardworking and is a quick study, and that she tends to win people over. I mean, what else? We already know all these facts about her.
As the documents show, and what makes them so interesting is not only, as everybody's been saying, that we get an actual, as close to the horse's mouth as possible here, but included in the documents that came out this week was the 92 strategy memo, in which they basically talk about how the public, through their polling and focus groups, takes her in. And one, it's just a great historical document to see, you know, a lot of these things still are the case with the way that women are perceived in the political context. And one of the quotes that I thought was so great from that campaign memo was that what voters find slick in Bill Clinton, they find ruthless in Hillary. So basically, she could do the same thing, it's just they sort her differently. And then there's another quote that while voters genuinely admire Hillary Clinton's intelligence and tenacity, they are uncomfortable with these traits in a woman. And then it says she needs to project a softer side, some humor and some informality. That was the same kind of thing she was struggling to do in 2008. And so it's interesting to me, from if she's going to be running again, the way in which people have obstacles to the view you have, David, because they see her as a very tough woman. And one thing you see in these memos, which is, at least in her conversations with her friend, she's a lot tougher than her husband. There are quotes throughout it where she says basically people in the administration aren't willing to be tough and mean enough. She talks about playing hardball. She's regularly basically trying to get the administration to be tougher and meaner than her husband wants to be.
So this concern about ruthlessness, which manifested itself in 92 and in the 90s Clinton presidency, and to a certain extent a little bit in the 2008 election and the 2008 campaign as well, I kind of feel like we're over this. That Americans, if they vote for Hillary Clinton to be president, it's not going to be because we need to humanize her. Like, she doesn't need to run a campaign which is all about making her human and having it be all about her romance with Bill. That basically people like her toughness and her ruthlessness, and that's fine. And that the conversation about a woman in politics is very different in 2016 or 2014 than it was in 1992. Thank goodness.
What in the last campaign in 2008 when she ran gave you evidence to support that view?
But John, she lost in 2008, I think, in large part because she had a really poorly run campaign in which they didn't use her well. They were kind of in cringe defensive mode once Barack Obama got going. And her best moment was when, you know, she let some emotion show and was able to save New Hampshire because of that. So I feel like the lesson there is to be a little less scripted and clinched in the way she presents herself.
You're saying, but you are arguing for emotion.
You're arguing against
David, I'm arguing for more emotion and informality, but I agree with you, David, that she doesn't have some huge mountain she has to climb here. I think basically at this point, her Secretary of State self is a very popular, solid one, and she doesn't have a whole lot of extra work she has to do. It's not like she has to reintroduce herself to us.
Yeah.
She just has to be
I agree
like
with that. That's totally true. I mean, she has perhaps more experience at all the different facets of powerful public life in Washington, then what? Then who's the last candidate who had that much experience? Well, maybe Nixon.
Adam, do you think that Hillary has to run as a human self as opposed to as a powerful, capable leader?
I do think the State Department Hillary, my sense is that has replaced the injured wife or the angry harpy or whatever caricature we have left over from the 90s. I think my image, when I close my eyes and picture Hillary as Secretary of State, it's this smiling, interesting person who's not, almost bears no resemblance to the characters of the 90s. So that's my gut instinct.
Can I interject one more point, David, just to support your point that we've talked about before and that I ended up writing about, but which is just separate and apart from the image portion of it, ruthlessness, as it portrays itself in these diaries, is a perfectly fine and, in fact, laudable trait in presidents and in successful politicians. So the fact that she has ruthlessness doesn't mean she immediately has its excesses. And, in fact, the fact that she's ruthless is going to be a good thing if she wants to be
president. Especially because so many Democrats feel that Barack Obama is not half ruthless enough. She's an antidote to that.
Right. But, John, isn't it just bad that we're talking about this at all now? Isn't this – there seems to be this huge narrative that Hillary's making exactly the same mistake that she made in 2006 of being the inevitable candidate, of everyone talking about her as the inevitable candidate way too early. So isn't this like the worst thing for her in that sense?
I think you're exactly right. There's a fatigue. Lots of us have written about it. I think people really, really like her. But then there are other people who are just kind of like, gosh, are we going to, you know, one of the things these papers did do is remind you that we've been enjoying the ups and downs of the Clinton family for 25 years. All of this speculation and talk about her and what she needs to do in a race that won't begin for 2 years, yeah, I think it just puts more kind of sludge in the system.
But that you can't blame that on her.
And no.
She didn't put it out there. It's not her making the mistake.
She's stuck, and she's – because the minute she tries to kind of shape anything, I thought this is completely out of her control. And that's a cross she has to bear, but I don't think there's anything she can do about it. Anything she would try to do about it would only kind of initiate the campaign earlier, which would exacerbate the underlying problem.
Emily, do you think that the conservatives are going to want to relitigate the entire 90s? Is that to have this discussion of Hillary go on and on like this for the reasons that you talked about, that they figure the more this stuff is discussed, the more people will get tired of her? Do you expect there's going to be the next 2 years where we're going to have a series of Hillary papers, Hillary papers, Hillary papers?
Yeah, I would do that if I was trying to stop her. I think the farther back in time you go, the less appealing she is. And the more you remind people of Monica Lewinsky and the sordid, squalid aspects of Bill Clinton, the worse for her. And the other thing is, the one thing that really did bother me from these new, you know, quote revelations was how cavalier she was about Bob Packwood, who, you know, was accused of all kinds of really bad behavior towards women. And she seemed to be blowing it off in the name of politics in a way that really, you know, acted as if it didn't matter what he'd done. And to me, that seemed pretty just wrong.
One last question, which is not about Hillary. It's about Diane Blair. So Diane Blair recorded all these conversations she had with Hillary Clinton when Hillary Clinton was, you know, prospective first lady and first lady. But she didn't publish it. She died, and the records were not released until someone kind of cannily went and found them. Is that what people are doing to every famous person, that every time you speak to somebody, they're going and writing it down?
Just to be fair to Blair, in these notes, she says Hillary asked her to keep track of all this stuff, to do an oral history and to keep a record of it.
So, I did not realize that.
Well, that changes it.
You know, and in part, CNN had a report today that when Blair at one point asked her why she wanted to keep records of all the healthcare stuff, that Mrs. Clinton's response was revenge. she wasn't just freelancing here. I think it's why all of the presidents, that's why they have taping systems. And this is what I thought, regardless of Hillary Clinton, what was so great about these diaries is it is a contemporaneous account of the crazy pressure cooker of the White House, in which, you know, all the assault that the Clintons were under, their remedy was to basically make it look like it wasn't bothering them at all, which only serves to double the kind of weight of all of this. And you really feel, in going through and reading this account of what it was like, the enormity of the stress they were under. And so presidents always turn to some system like this to say, I got to write my own record of this because I'm getting so destroyed in the press.
All right. Coming up, can anything stop the decline of the American middle class? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. The American middle class is in crisis. the recovery from the Great Recession, all the gains in the economy from the Great Recession have gone to the top 5% of Americans, with a teeny bit to the top 20%. The bottom 80% have lost ground in the past 5 years. And that's on top of a general decline. And Congress appears unwilling to act. So, Adam Davidson, this is a subject that you have been thinking about a lot. Is the middle class in as much trouble as the kind of cursory look at the data suggests?
The simple answer is definitely. I will say inequality is such a huge topic. I honestly would like to start a weekly radio show called like This Week in Inequality, because it is so rich and so complicated and so battled over. I mean, you can just cause a bar fight at any American Economic Association gathering of economists. And the biggest fights are actually on the left, between sort of the far left and the middle left among economists. The right is sort of weirdly out of the conversation on inequality for the most part. So my first thought is, which inequality are we talking about? You know, there's the big, big gap between the very, very rich. So the richest 30,000 or richest 300,000 people in America, the 0.1% or the 0.01%. And that's the shocking, wow, that is crazy, how that tiny slice of the economy is taking so much of the gains. But then there's the big gaping middle, where the median wage doesn't mean as much anymore, because while wages used to be very compressed around the middle, now they're really dividing out, where the floor is falling away. But then some percentage in that top 20% are doing better and better and better. And there's a lot of churn in that top 20%, where a lot of the people in the top 20 are spending a decent amount of their careers in the top 5, in the top 2%. And so having these volatile but fairly good wages. So all of these dimensions are happening all at the same time, which creates a very complex picture, some of which seems that there are policy tools that could happen, although won't happen because of Congress, but others of which, because they seem to be happening everywhere in the world all at once, seem to be just a result of increasing global trade, increasing, you know, computer technology, those kinds of things. And there's just not that much we can do about it.
Well, which are the things that we can do something about?
So there's the short-term crisis, which is now becoming a medium-term to long-term crisis, the Great Recession. And while not many people have the same intense certainty that Paul Krugman has, I would guess that the majority of economists, 60, 70% of economists, would strongly support, or certainly would have in 2008, 2009, a much more robust stimulus package, a much more aggressive action by the Fed even earlier, and would have supported that happening all around the world. So none of this austerity in Europe type stuff. And I think we don't know for sure. We'll never know for sure. But compelling research that would make life an awful lot better for an awful lot of people. So that's one set of policy tools we just completely took off the table because of Congress. I mean, we did have the $800 billion stimulus, but we didn't have the $2 trillion or greater stimulus that people felt was needed. The other tools, you start getting into really weak beer. I mean, you have minimum wage. You can increase minimum wage. We don't know exactly how high you can increase it before you start having negative employment effects. But probably, you know, the Seattle SeaTac experiment of $15 an hour seems like that might be a little too high. That's going to start hurting the poor more than helping them. So you can raise minimum wage. Not that much you can do. There's some stuff you can do with the tax code. But I don't know that there's a clear set of policy tools for that hollowing out of the middle. I mean, the language a lot of the economists use is language of a lost generation, that basically what we can focus on is educating young people today so they have a better shot in the future at moving up the income ladder.
Do we even know how to educate people in a way that they would be a better match for this kind of decent to well-paid set of jobs that are now feel like they're missing, the sort of the manufacturing jobs of the past? I mean, we haven't had an answer to that question now for quite a while.
When people tell you, oh, it's all about education, that's kind of a non-answer. In the short to medium term, 5 years to even 20 years, it's hard to think how education really does a lot, except on the mark. I mean, if you're talking to your nephew and your nephew's saying, hey, maybe I'm going to drop out of college. Don't drop out of college. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would be a very bad idea.
Don't think of Bill Gates. That's not the odds on choice.
Yes, exactly. So, but for macroeconomic interventions, it's more like, well, when you have a better educated population, the economy tends to grow more down the road. So hopefully by educating people in, you know, 40 years, 50 years will be a richer, more flexible economy.
So I want to go to the politics of this, and I want to throw this to you, John, which is this problem that Adam is describing affects the majority of Americans. So there's a very small percentage of Americans who are thriving in this new economy, and the majority are going backwards. So even if you're a Republican who's drawing, you know, support from wealthier individuals, still the majority of your constituents are suffering this economy. Why is the Republican or the conservative view about what to do about this so radically different and non-interventionist?
Yeah, I think, it's a mix. I think they think that at the very least you want to stop adding new, complicated, big, hard-to-work programs like healthcare. So they would say you don't want to add more stuff that causes complexity for small businesses and causes a lot of extra behavior that doesn't go towards economic growth. Then they would say you want to knock back those regulations, lower taxes. But there is a group that includes people like Rand Paul that believes a lot of money should be spent on infrastructure. And then there's also a group in the Republican Party that believes in George Bush and his brother among them, who believes in a federal role for education. So you can't say it's the whole party. It's just that in the current sclerosis we're in, nobody's happening with anything. And then finally, we should also mention that one way that you would be able
But John, just to interrupt, I mean, to go to Adam's point, which is that the vast majority of economists believe that in the Great Recession, there would needed to be a stimulus of two or three times as big as the one the U.S. passed with no Republican vote. So you, in fact, have a Republican Party which is going against what the vast majority of economists, what the total consensus about economic wisdom is, for helping the economy. So why
is
that?
You couldn't have gotten a stimulus package greater than $800 billion through the Senate with Democratic votes. So it's not the Republicans.
What do you mean it's not the Republicans? They didn't support a stimulus package at all.
Your point is, oh, these horrible Republicans. The politics that kept the stimulus where it was not just about Republicans. There were Democrats who weren't going to vote for something that big either. So,
well, except, John, I mean, I feel like the universe of the possible is defined by, you know, the right as well as the left. And so,
That's right. It's defined by both. It's not just defined by the right.
If Republican senators had come along and said we need $1.5 trillion, then you could have done it without Lieberman.
Right.
There was no Republican senators who were coming along to do it. No Republican senators were aligning with the consensus economic position about what needed to be done. Not one.
Although, in all fairness, at the time, was it really a consensus position? I
Adam
feel like
Davidson,
it's more
was
and more
it?
In hindsight.
No, it at the time, $800 billion was closer to the consensus. You had very strong voices saying it needed
Krugman
to be more.
Paul Krugman was saying bigger, but I don't feel like I feel like people have lined up more and more with him since then, whereas at the moment I remember thinking, huh, is he really right
Although,
about that?
Also, we should note that Susan Collins, Olympia Snowe, and Arlen Specter did vote for the stimulus just as a sort of
factual correction.
To get out there before David.
No one in the House. No,
totally
none in the House.
The grid right. here.
None in the House.
David retreats to the other camera of the legislature.
So, Adam, one last question about this, which is, are there other examples of countries that have hollowed out their middle class, countries that have had big, strong middle classes, which then got very rich and very poor?
It's new, but it's happening everywhere. So that was the point I was trying to make earlier, is that the super elite inequality, the kind of Occupy Wall Street stuff, that seems to be an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon. We're not seeing that as much in continental Europe, in Japan. But in all industrialized nations, we are seeing this hollowing out of the middle. It's happening in different ways, especially, you know, in Germany and elsewhere, but all of them are seeing, especially for younger people, all those great labor packages that we think of Europeans as having. We're seeing those go away. We're seeing these dual labor systems where kind of older workers have wonderful deals and younger workers are much more exposed to the market. And so that is why many economists say, well, if it's happening everywhere and it's happening all at the same time, in fact, it happened more in Europe than it did in America earlier. So it seems that it is somehow embedded in a high technology, highly globalized economy where a variety of market forces add enormous earnings to those at the top and create enormous competitive pressures for those at the bottom and forces people in the middle to sort of choose, or not choose, but shoves them either to the top or the bottom. And so it's happening everywhere, but it's so new, we don't know what that looks like. I mean, that's why people start using analogies like, you know, developing countries that are just kleptocracies.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, The Lego Movie is a hit with both audiences and critics. We'll discuss it. And then we'll talk about the Sochi Olympics and the parlous state of Putin's Russia with the journalist Masha Gessen. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steven.
Hello, Dana. Oh, my Lord. Well, let me start with you. This is a movie, after all, and you are a movie critic. The Lego Movie, oh, the improbabilities. The Lego Movie is a computer-animated branded entertainment about interlocking plastic bricks. It sounds awful until you remind yourself the creators of the toys are Danish, and the creators of the movie previously brought us Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. This marriage has resulted in maybe the biggest February movie of all time, time, time. Dana, I sneak previewed your review because I was trying to work out my own. I don't do that often, but I did this time. You loved it, this mini figment of the imagination. I loved it too, but tell me, or I liked
Wait,
it very
Steve,
much.
Wait, Steve, can we just say, so of all the movies we've seen in 6 years, it's the Legos movie that has so befuddled you, you had to see what Dana said before the show? I love it.
Interlocking brick clouds of consternation now are gathering above my head. You broke my rhythm. Dana, what did you think of this movie?
Yeah, I agree. I think the Lego Movie was certainly the most fun I've had at the movies in 2014. I mean, given we're only in week six of the year, you know, I'm not sure exactly how much that's saying, but it was a huge surprise for me. I've already said this on the spoiler special that I taped with David Haglund about the movie, which I encourage people to listen to because this movie does contain some big spoilers that we will be avoiding in this segment. But the thing I was saying is that this movie turned my mood around on a horrible, horrible night. It was a cold, freezy, slushy night. It was the day after Philip Seymour Hoffman had died. I'd been up all night the night before writing about him and just being, you know, extremely sad. And I just couldn't believe I had to see this damn movie about plastic bricks. And I'll be damned if the movie didn't completely turn my mood around and have me laughing for the entire time. I think it's wonderful.
All right, before we go any further, let's listen to a clip. Dana, you wanna set this one up?
Yeah, so I think the one we're going to listen to is the very beginning of the movie. The main character, Emmett Brickowski, voiced by Chris Pratt, delightfully, I think, is waking up on his average boring day in Bricksburg to start his day of constructing the same exact towers that he spends every day of his conformist life constructing.
Good morning, apartment. Good morning, doorway. Morning, wall. Morning, ceiling. Good morning, floor. Ready to start the day. Ah, here it is. Instructions to fit in, have everybody like you, and always be happy. Step one, breathe. Okay, got that one down. Step two, greet the day, smile, and say,
Good morning, city!
Good morning! Step three, exercise. Jumping jacks, hit them. One, two.
One of the things I want to direct our listeners to is just you can hear the little tap-tap of his little Lego legs tapping on the Lego floor when he's doing those jumping jacks. And it's part of, I think, the great sound design and visual design of this movie that it feels so Lego-y. I mean, it really has a tactile quality that makes you really feel like you are in the biggest box of Legos of all time, which
Absolutely.
Is part of why it's really fun.
Yeah, let's say their names. It's co-written by and co-directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who brought, as I said, Julia brought us Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, which I had blown off seeing, assuming it was nonsense, and it's not. It's a real delight. It struck me that this movie was, too. What did you think?
I loved it. I mean, you know, I'm not sure it's the rarest thing ever these days, a kids movie that is larded with jokes that might tickle adults as well. But I just really appreciated the particularity of the sense of humor of this movie. This movie was funny, not in an obvious knee-slap way, but just in an offbeat way with lots of little subtle sly jokes that kind of emerge over time. The evil weapon in the movie is called the Craggle, and when the movie gets to the reveal of why it's called the Craggle, it's not a laugh-out-loud joke. It's just a tiny, clever, smart little pun that delighted me, and there were lots of little moments like that throughout the movie that I thought were particularly charming.
Okay, well, so Dana, Julia found the movie charming and filled with little bibelots, and but you found it, not to put words in your mouth, but if I remember your review correctly, you found it profound in some way, right? That it was, that it was actually these little interlocking plastic toys together form a kind of parable.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll be probably taken down for saying this because it is obviously a movie that was made in close collaboration with Lego. It is a branded entertainment, and in some ways, I guess it's an extended toy commercial. But I was truly surprised to the degree to which it did not feel like an extended toy commercial of any kind. And in fact, that this
kind of allegorical message that it has, which we'll get to, is somewhat subversive. I mean, it's not exactly anti-capitalist. I don't think the Lego movie is aiming to bring down the world economy in any way. But it is sort of pro-doing with what you have, right? Because the philosophical divide in this movie is in between children and adults in one way, but also sort of in between spontaneity and planning, right? Between building something that comes in a kit that you have to build in a certain way, which the main character, this little construction minifigure named Emmett, is that's sort of the world that he knows at the beginning. He only knows how to build things according to the directions, and the whole movie is about him meeting these radicals, right, who are trying to overthrow that system for something that's more creative, and who are called master builders, who can build anything out of any random collection of Lego bricks. And I did find that divide to be pretty compelling in terms of, you know, this movie tried to grapple with themes that not that many children's movies do.
It did make me uneasy, though, that even though the movie trots out anti-corporate themes, the villain in the movie is called President Business. Like, literally, the villain's name is Business. Didn't you feel a little bit like Big Lego was kind of co-opting? I mean, I don't even believe in co-option. I feel like of the three of us, I believe least in co-option as something we should all despise and decry, but I felt like they were kind of co-opting radicalism and in the name of selling Legos.
I don't know. What do you think, Steve? I mean, I feel like that's sort of the reflexive Tom Frank, you know, position would be to batten down on the cynicism of this whole endeavor, and that the fact that it's called the Lego movie and that the Lego company in Denmark was a big part of helping to develop it with Phil Lord and Chris Miller. But I don't know. All I can say is that the thing that I see on the screen does not feel to me like its primary function and purpose is to sell us Legos. I also took my child to see it over the weekend because I wanted to see, I had seen it, you know, by myself at a press screening with a lot of adults who were laughing and enjoying it. But seeing it in a movie theater with a bunch of kids was a completely different experience. It was like wild pandemonium and joy. And I have no idea whether every single one of those kids bugged their parent afterwards to buy them a branded Lego kit, but mine didn't. Mine wanted to go home and play with her big box of random assorted Legos and just sort of reenact the movie in her mind. I also have to say that she really, really loved the character of Unikitty, voiced by Alison Brie, who is this great, I think, a great parody of girl-branded toys. She's this pink combination unicorn and kitten who's adorable and bubbly and optimistic about everything, but she functions on this well of repressed rage, and every time it comes out, you know, she turns into this crazy rage cat that wreaks havoc on people. And of course, my 7-year-old daughter loved both sides of Unikitty.
All right. Well, I'm going to pause it in order to answer the question. At one end of the spectrum is the social theorist and writer Thomas Frank, who edited The Baffler. He wrote What's the Matter with Kansas? And he has this great phrase, commodify your dissent. Dana, I think that's why you name-checked him, right?
Right, exactly.
That our ability to say, oh, this is just a big, giant advertisement is appropriated by the movie itself making fun of things being giant advertisements and agents of pacification, political pacification, at the other end of which is the wonderful Preston Sturges movie Sullivan's Travels, which is about a director who tries to exit the Hollywood system for exactly that reason, and by the end of it, he understands that movies are just helping people live through the Depression. It's one of the great American comedies ever made, and so that's the spectrum, and I think where you fall on it shouldn't have to do with your own personality. It should have to do with the dignity of the movie under consideration. And in this instance, I'm willing to very happily say it's way more on the Preston Sturges end of the spectrum than on the Tom Frank. I really liked it. I thought it commodified my dissent beautifully.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out why this version of it made me slightly more uneasy than versions that do it more clumsily. Almost because it was so effective and so funny and so sprightly and so wry and so winking and sophisticated about everything, making fun of how much coffee costs, making fun of, you know, within the Lego movie with the stamp of approval of Lego executives, making fun of failed Lego sets and making fun of the fact that so many of the Lego figurines are branded. So there's a Wonder Woman Lego and there's a Gandalf Lego. All comes in for mockery, and I wanted to ride it happily over the horizon, and I think it was the excellence of the execution almost that made me feel like perhaps somebody was slipping me a Mickey.
Oh, my God, Julia, it's taken me only 5 years, but I've slowly converted you into a European-style cultural critic.
One other thing I really loved about this movie, and I know, Steve, that I also think it's a sinister agent of evil, but I also loved it because it's such a successful sinister agent of evil. And one of the things I really loved about it was the look and was the sophistication of this stop-motion CG hybrid, because it really focused on the limitations of Legos. There are a lot of jokes wrung out of the fact that
Lego figurines have these little claw hands, and so if two Legos fall in love, should any Legos happen to fall in love in this movie, all they can do to consummate their love is interlock their claw hands and gaze at each other and kind of lean in for a little head nod toward each other. And they can also only grasp food that is shaped appropriately to go in their claw hands. And yet to make something so expressive and interesting within those constraints is both impressive and exciting to me, and also thematically in line with the movie, right, which is about how the limits of a particular set can inspire endless creativity.
Julia, that was very well put, and I'm glad that you ended with that, because I think that gestures toward this twist ending that I don't want to spoil, but which has to do with the different ways of playing with toys and whether you are one of these master builders who can whip anything up spontaneously or someone who has to proceed according to the rules. And it just seems really obvious that the filmmakers, both in thematically and in the creation of the film itself, are really embracing that spontaneous side. And capitalist overlords or no, I find that hard not to root for.
All right. Well, the movie's the Lego Movie. It's a huge hit. Go see it. Tell us what you thought about it at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Coming up, is Sochi reviving our Cold War mentality? You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gabfest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mention on the program, well, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, while you're there, if you would, leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, moving on. Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist who has emerged as the most vital critical voice of Russia under the leadership of Vladimir Putin. Her new book, Words Will Break Cement, followed the state-sponsored torments of the punk band Pussy Riot, who, for acts of civil disobedience, were subject to a very Gulag archipelago-style treatment, including a show trial, a sentence of hard labor in Siberia. Pussy Riot is now free, and Putin is now sponsoring the Olympics. But somewhere between Putin's ambition for these games to showcase a new Russia and the bemused and bemusing tweets from Western journalists about filthy drinking water and substandard accommodation lies a deeper and a quite troubling reality. Russia's ominous slide into the dark ages is a phrase that comes from Masha Gessen's work. Masha joins us to talk about these issues and more. Masha, thank you so much for coming on our show.
It has been my dream to come on your show.
Oh my God!
Wow.
Well, it's one of ours to have you on. So two dreams collide. Masha, you're a Russian. You have a U.S. passport. You're gay, and you have an adopted Russian child. But we're going to start with the Olympics. What about the Winter Games is confirming or disaffirming your view of the Russia that you know?
Well, I've actually been following the endless tweets about the broken toilets and the bobsledder who was first stuck in his bathroom and had to break a hole in it and then was stuck in the elevator today. But this is the Russia that the world should see. I mean, this is the Russia in which sort of everyday existence is demeaning and humiliating. And that's actually a great insight into why the protest movement came to be a couple of years ago in Russia.
You've also said that the reaction of Russians, including many Russians who, when the Olympics are not going on, might be very critical of Putin and of what's going on in their country, you know, they become sort of nationalistic when it comes to, you know, hearing the country be put down for its substandard welcome of journalists and foreigners.
I can't wrap my mind around this. I mean, I've been glued to Facebook and Twitter and trying to figure out what's going on, because there's this piece in the New Republic that Julia Yoffe wrote about how Russians are getting mad at the Schadenfreude of American coverage. And I'm getting that from a lot of my friends in Moscow, that they feel like this is a personal insult. There's something about this sort of call to national unity and this desire to see the Olympics as a common triumph that works. And I'm fascinated with why it works.
I'm interested in thinking about it from the American journalist perspective, where a lot of the people who are tweeting their dirty tap water maybe have more of a general sense that things are not right in Russia, that Russia is sliding towards dictatorship under Putin. And so, you know, that Julia Yaffe piece discussed how it seemed kind of like poor etiquette to complain about shoddy toilets or something like that. And I think there is a little bit of a misplaced sense of, well, I can like stick it to Putin by complaining about the toilet, right? Like maybe you wouldn't think complaining about the toilet was tweet-worthy if there weren't the sense of, oh, if the Americans can descend and all show the subpar hotel experience and have that be like a political strike against Putin. I mean, there's sort of this misalignment, the sense that maybe if you critique the games as disorganized and shoddy, somehow you are also striking a blow for democracy, for Western understanding of the state of Russia. And it sounds like you're saying in some ways that might be true.
Absolutely. I mean, this is Putin's big party. This is something that he's worked toward for 7 years. He personally went to Guatemala City in 2007 to lobby the International Olympic Committee to have the Olympics in Russia. He wanted to be back in office in time to host the Olympics. I mean, this is like somebody is throwing a big party at a house that he has advertised for a long time, and you go over and there's no tap water and the food is awful. You know, and then you get stuck in the bathroom, have to break a hole in it. And if you're called upon to sort of evaluate the party, I think it's perfectly appropriate to write about this stuff. I think what's missing is sort of a second level of analysis, which is that link between what they're seeing and what this says about Russia and what this says about the way that Russia spends its tax money, the way that Russia treats its citizens, the fact that more than half of all Russians actually do not have regular access to clean drinking water. Which, you know, considering that we're talking about one of the wealthiest countries in the world, is absolutely mind-boggling. But I don't think we should expect that kind of analysis from Twitter. I mean, that's sort of our job.
And also, Masha, let's put a fine point on it, right? It's not that the ill-functioning toilets and bad drinking water are only signifiers of incompetence or a low level of personal service. It's almost like, you know, the metaphor I was thinking of is I had nesting dolls is always the trite metaphor people use when talking about Russia, so I had nesting toilets instead. To get the picture straight, you have both a strongman dictator and a massively inefficient society that's suppressing civil liberties massively. It's creating enormous negative externalities, which is the polite way to say it's making drinking water impotable and toxic, on and on. And then to pull off the Olympics, Putin has created, I'm using your language here, a small military regime within an authoritarian society in order to bring them off without a hitch. And for that to malfunction is an enormous tell.
Absolutely. I mean, it actually gives us a look into the level of corruption in Russia and the effect that that corruption has on the functioning of government. Yes, it's a disintegrating state. And again, a broken toilet and non-working electricity in a hotel room are pretty good indicators of the extent to which life in Russia has disintegrated.
Masha, it bears repeating, right, that this was, when it was the Soviet Union, Russia was the great symbolic enemy and also kind of mirror of the United States. And we were ideological foes. The Cold War came to an end, and there was this huge and open question of what Russia would become. Where does it go next? I mean, where exactly does it go in the direction of Pussy Riot and gay rights, or does it go in the direction of backlash and repression with or without Putin?
I would actually take issue with that narrative a little bit. I think Putin very much wants to be seen as a strongman who brought law and order back to Russia. Law and order sort of started to be restored before Putin came along. As often happens in politics, the perception was sort of lagging behind. But basically, after Russia's financial system collapsed in 1998, things started to be put back together. And by the time Putin came into office, violent crime was way down compared to the 1990s. Trains were running on time. The post office was working again. He sort of rode the wave of that, and he rode the incredible wave of oil prices. So he's ridden this wave of an unprecedented wealth in Russian history, which has contributed to his image as the savior of Russia. But what's been lacking this entire time, and I think you pointed this out correctly, is Russia's identity both domestically and on the international stage. Like, what is Russia going to be now? Well, Russia has figured out what it's going to be now. It's going to be the traditional values capital of the world. Mm. It began with the scapegoating of gays and lesbians, and then it turned out to have amazing traction, and now this is Russia's new ideology.
But is there any cause for optimism at all? And the analogy isn't a strong one, but in the United States a few years ago, one felt as though, rightly, the Democratic Party might go down along with gay rights and gay marriage as an issue, that conservatives would cynically put it on the ballot as a way of fomenting a backlash. And lo and behold, in almost what amounted to a blink of an eye, the closet came to an end. Gay repression came nearly to an end. Gay marriage is now a huge plurality of American voters, if not a majority, are behind it. And all of a sudden, on a dime, what one thought was going to be a kind of evangelical backlash against gay rights turned around again. Is there any hope that the Olympics or the Pussy Riot situation are a harbinger for civil society emerging in Putin's Russia, or is that just completely pie in the sky?
Completely pie in the sky.
Yeah.
To answer your question seriously, Steve, there are too many distinctions to list between the United States and Russia. But basically, the big distinction is that we're talking about a dictatorship. And what Putin has done in the face of a mass protest movement is the smartest thing a dictator can do. The smartest thing for a dictator to do is to crack down brutally. And that's exactly what he has done. It began as a classic sort of scapegoating story. Can we pick one minority that we can mobilize the entire population against? And gays and lesbians seemed like a really good choice. I mean, first of all, it's easy to convince the public that they've never seen a gay or lesbian person in their lives, so it's easy to create a monster. And, of course, he also believed that this was the one minority he could beat up on without the world noticing. And then it turned out that there was all this potential there, that you could, as he has put it, Russia is the light of conservative values that stands up to the darkness of tolerance that is creeping in from the West. I think that has a lot of hold. And I think even if Putin goes, yeah, that can stick around for a long time.
Do you think that the Olympics overall will deepen and focus international attention on Russia, or is deflecting from it?
I think the Olympics have been great for bringing international attention to Russia. The question is what happens after the Olympics. You know, China repealed the death penalty before the Olympics and then reinstated it after the Olympics. And Putin is going to do something similar. I think the crackdown is going to intensify hugely after the Games. I mean, I think that civil society activists will go to jail in greater numbers and with much harsher sentences than we've ever seen.
Masha Gessen is the author of Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Masha, thank you so much for coming on our show to talk about this.
Thank you.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our show, of course, where we endorse. Dana, what do you got?
Okay, so I was reading on the wires this morning that Shirley Temple Black passed away yesterday at the age of 85. She obviously had a long and fascinating life as a child superstar in the 30s and going on to be a diplomat. And I didn't realize until I started reading about her this morning that her daughter was actually in the punk group The Melvins. So she's had a crazy Zelig life where she's popped up everywhere. And I encourage people to go and read all about her, even if you've never seen one of her kid movies. But one of the most, to me, incredible anecdotes about her that I came across in my research this morning was a story about her and Graham Greene in a film review that he wrote of a movie she was in 1937. So there was a brief period when the novelist Graham Greene wrote film reviews for various British publications. And for a publication called Night and Day, he wrote a review of Wee Willie Winkie, which is a Shirley Temple movie that came out in 1937, directed by John Ford. And this review became a huge scandal, and Graham Greene was sued for libel successfully by 20th Century Fox. Greene fled to Mexico, where he wrote one of his greatest novels, The Power and the Glory, which actually was subsequently filmed by John Ford as well. So all of that story is fascinating, but the content of the letter is sort of incredible, and I wanted to read a little bit of it. And, you know, why he was sued for libel will become evident when you hear some of what he wrote. So this is the first sentence of his Wee Willie Winkie review. The owners of a child star are like leaseholders. Their property diminishes in value every year. Time's chariot is at their backs. Miss Shirley Temple's case, though, has peculiar interest. Infancy with her is a disguise. Her appeal is more secret and more adult. And then skipping ahead a little bit. Middle-aged men and clergymen respond to her dubious coquetry, to the sight of her well-shaped and desirable little body, packed with enormous vitality, only because the safety curtain of story and dialogue drops between their intelligence and their desire. Okay, so essentially, he's writing this review about the pervy audience that's getting off on, you know, the sweet tap dancing angel that was Shirley Temple. And this was a complete scandal at the time. Of course, it reads now like sort of amazingly sharp sociological criticism, but at the time was essentially considered, you know, just sheer lechery. And he was sort of run out of town on a rail for it. It's a very short little review. I think it's around 600 words long, but it's really worth finding. So we'll link to a blog post about Graham Greene and his review of Wee Willie Winkie.
Oh, that's fantastic. I love anything having to do with Graham Greene in movies. Julia Turner, what do you have?
All right. My endorsement this week is a super fun app for your iPhone or iPad that is also edifying and life-improving. I have been wanting to brush up my Italian, which is very rusty or arrugginato, and I have discovered Duolingo, which Seth Stevenson, our technology writer, wrote about in Slate a few weeks ago. And basically, Duolingo gamifies language learning, which sounds like the odious sort of thing that a Silicon Valley executive would say, except it seems to be true. Basically, you do little lessons, and you get kind of points and trumpets blaring every time you successfully type off a round of prepositions. You can compete against your friends, and it's completely free. It's the
product of the same guy who invented that CAPTCHA system, the really annoying thing that you have to type in the squiggly letters.
Man.
Yeah, so basically as penance for forcing us all to waste our time proving we're not robots, he's invented this wonderful free app. So I highly recommend it, Duolingo. Download it now.
All right. Well, Julia's endorsement gives me the perfect opening to issue a correction, which is I was making a joke when I claimed that I was watching a French television show without subtitles. The idea that I could do that is outrageous. I'm not even close to having that level of French skill. So just correcting the record, I'm watching Spiral, the French TV show, completely subtitled. But anyway,
wait till you do your Duolingo round, Steve. Then you'll just be able to put a little piece of masking tape up on the bottom of the screen just within weeks.
I love that you think it takes masking tape to get rid of subtitles on something. Right? Isn't it?
Look, I'm trying to make the world over as I can.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm very quickly going to endorse. I can't believe I've never done it. I actually think the second best thing I've ever watched on television after The Wire is the BBC version of Traffic, which then got made into a rather indifferent movie by Steven Soderbergh. But the original BBC version of it is as good as television, serial television, has ever been. It really is that good, and you can find it somewhere. I'm assuming it's streaming. It's just as good as anything you've ever seen. Check it out. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much, Dana.
Thank you, Stephen.
Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gapfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, or the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll talk to you next week.
You're having tea with Graham Greene in a colored costume of your choice, and you'll be thought in high esteem if you're seen in between. Stiffly holding umbrellas, catching the